Woohoo! Welcome to the Somewhere Call Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
We're recording Tuesday morning before getting on a flight to California. What?
Yeah.
It's so weird. I think the world is opening up a little bit. We're traveling. What is going on?
It's so weird. Not having to wear masks everywhere, I realized that my teeth have gotten really rough in the pandemic. I need to start focusing on hygiene a little bit more.
Well, sorry, I was packing last night. I have a business trip to go back to for California, and you're coming with me. And all of a sudden, I was like going through my clothes and was having an existential crisis because I was like, I have to wear business on the top and business on the bottom.
Business on the bottom.
What is going on right now? Because like, you know, when I was doing my Zoom presentations, I was just wearing like pajama shorts and then a nice top. And it is so weird to wear dress pants again.
Yeah. We had like a full year that was kind of the mullet year. A business on the top, party on the bottom. And now you're having to like chop off your back mullet. Your rat tail is gone. This is really no fun at all.
All kinds of things going on. Well, we have someone coming to our house to watch Addie while we're gone. And it was the first time we've really had anyone like come inside our house for an extended period of time in over a year. And it was a great impetus to clean.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think when it's just the two of us, it's like, whatever. Like we're really busy. We'll like solve that like the microwave like disaster explosion crisis later. Or like, you know, things are kind of a mess. And we just look past it.
Yeah, I feel like the problem with me with cleaning is that I just get the bare minimum to get by. It's like, okay, I don't want to live in a total pigsty, but I'm not going to clean much, right? And the problem is now when someone else is seeing it, it's like, oh, wait, this is actually a pigsty to other people.
Well, it's funny. Actually, the way to get me to clean is to have someone else to come over. Because when I'm living here, I'm like, whatever. Like, this is just us. When someone else is coming over, I'm like, it must be nice. So this weekend, I was like opening up everything and like seeing things for the first time. I think I opened up the microwave and was like, oh, no. Because there just was like, you know, like soup explosions or like whatever happened there. Or the silverware drawer, because David's great strategy with silverware is just to like pick it up out of the dishwasher, out of the sink when it's clean, and just plop it into the silverware drawer without like organizing at all.
Well, the great thing about the microwave is that there were all the like little crunchies that had formed. So they would just precipitate. And sometimes you'd get nice crunch into your like your bowls of oatmeal.
Actually, sometimes Addie goes, she like walks to our kitchen. She's just like a little like drive-by lick of the microwave because she's like, what could be on here?
Well, so if you are listening to this and think that we have our shit together, we're just assuring you that we do not. Actual quote from Megan last night is, David, do you think all of these flies are dead because something in our house is poisonous?
Yeah, I did ask that. It was kind of like the dead bird thing. I was like, what if we're breathing like carbon monoxide? Yeah, like what is going on?
These are the canaries in the coal mine. Are these like these flies in the world? But we also wanted to do a follow-up on last week's episode on transgender athlete rights. Thank you so much. The reception has been wonderful. It's actually been the highest listened to episode ever.
Which brings me so much joy. Like if we could have one episode that could be like our highest listened, like let's make it that one. Like I think we're both just like so passionate on that topic. And just like the amount of support and love we received was just overwhelming and awesome.
Yeah. So thank you all, including people that don't fully agree with us, that we're there for the conversation. You know, I think that that's what we need to start doing on all these topics is like, okay, whatever our preconceived notions are, let's be willing to push those boundaries just a little bit. That being said, while it was great feedback for the most part, we did see that like one star bar for reviews on the podcast go up a good bit.
Actually, you saw the one star bar. So David is like, he's our podcast like data metrics person. I want you to filter it. I want to see it through your eyes because you're so positive and amazing. So when you told me that we got some quote unquote one star reviews, it's probably like a whole mountain of them is what I'm thinking as it's filtered.
So I read all the research about imposter syndrome and said that, you know, most of imposter syndrome is people grasping on to the negative reviews and not the positive ones. So I've really focused on the positive reviews in life. So I see a positive review and I'm like, hell yeah. I see like a one-star review and I'm like, they probably just don't view the world the same as I do.
You did share with me a priceless one-star review, which was, I think, just given like 2 or 3 days ago after the transgender episode. It was, their energy gives me anxiety. Wow. Also, I'm kind of honored.
Yeah, I know.
We got high energy, man.
I know. I love that we can push the needle that much. And it reminds me like when you're a child, you know, everyone's like, oh, their energy, bring that into the world, share that with everyone. And then 20 years later, the world's like, their energy gives me anxiety.
20 years later, the world's like, meh.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, which brings us to the point last night we had this big conversation surrounding the word meh. And I think it's like pretty relevant, actually.
Yeah, so my only role in coaching, like in terms of how people communicate with me, is that I don't let the word meh be in their training logs, which is such a weird and
like, and you're specific... pretty like, you're pretty vocal with that. Like sometimes,
oh no, it's a hard role. Yeah.
You have shared that with me, and sometimes I'll see it in athletes' training logs, and I'll just kind of look at it and be like, should I say something? And then I'm like, I'll let it pass. And I've never said anything, but you were like pretty vocal about
I think
it.
It's like a verbal emotional compulsion / tick for me. Like it's not even rational. It's just that the word meh, I have seen almost never correlate with good outcomes in anything with athletics or life or views. And so for me, that word became the ultimate like crusade against the word meh.
Well, I feel like meh to me just signals like apathy or like just like total, like it's almost like someone wanting to play it cool and like trying to play it cool, but actually experience like fighting or like repressing emotions. I don't know. I would much rather the word like fuck or no or ah, but like,
or this isn't for me or something
like that. Yeah. Something along those lines. Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like with our podcast series, I'm actually very happy because we have, you know, I got to be honest, pretty good 5-star bar, but also a pretty good 1-star bar and very few 3-stars.
I was going to say 3-stars are kind of the worst. 3-stars are like the meh of podcast reviews.
Yeah. Actually, it's probably going to go up after this podcast.
I know. We're just going to give out another one, but like meh.
All the people whose anxieties were spiking with that energy being like, screw you. This is what you asked for.
I was fascinated though, because I was like, I don't think meh has been in our like language and our like linguistics for a long time. And so I went back. It's actually, it's derived from like, the theory is that it came from like Yiddish language.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. But then the Simpsons largely, like they were the ones who like brought it into popularity, or even the ones that coined it. It's kind of debated. But so essentially Bart and Lisa were trying to pry the kids away from watching TV, and the kids are like, meh, which I feel like is the perfect origin story for that word.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like the problem with meh is it's just hard to fully experience everything. So like what I was thinking is imagining the Sistine Chapel, you know, where God is reaching down to man and saying, let there be light. And man reaches up and says, meh. You know, it's like all of existence
or like,
in the universe.
You know that meme of like the dog in the burning building?
Yeah.
And the dog would just be like, meh.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, that being said, a lot of things are a little bit like, you know, it is in the middle ground. I would just say try to avoid that at all costs, because like life is way less fun as meh.
Do you also know it's been co-opted into a noun? It's a goddamn noun. You can
really?
Say menace, which is like, I know, to me that's like, that's taking it to a next level. I feel like we don't need to go there.
I'm not a fan of that at all. So yeah, actually, that brings us up to one last thing on the follow-up for last week. We listened back for one of the first times to the podcast.
We really wanted it to be like, this is the first time. We like heavily scrutinized that podcast. Most of these podcasts, we hit the record. We prepare heavily and then hit the record button, and we're like, we're just sending that out into the ether. We're going to see what happens.
Yeah. And we listen back and notice that we do get the verbal tics sometimes. So to give Megan some credit, you said the word fundamentally
so many times. Yeah. And I apologize. That is like a strong effort.
I never thought that would be our F word, but that was our F word on that podcast. It was so many times. That being said, the things were fundamental, so perhaps it worked well.
And I think that leads us to another word that we've been using this week that we've honestly just kind of made up. And that word is ottering.
Yeah. So last week on Twitter, I saw a video of otters at the zoo holding hands while they were sleeping. And I was like, that's very cool and also a great idea.
And so we've been doing it because I think it like holds us to like sleeping accountability. Yeah. So for me, I often wake up at like 2 a.m. to go pee in the middle of the night and can't fall back asleep. And I feel like if I come and hold your hand and lie there, it keeps me, because I don't want to wake you up as I'm holding your hand if I'm like moving around. So it keeps me from like looking at my phone or reading a book or like, you know, moving in bed, staring at the ceiling. And it actually helps me fall back asleep.
Yeah.
Having that accountability to hold your hand.
For me, it's naps where I'm like, well, I got stuff to do. I can't stop like moving. And then with a nap, I'm like, Megan needs this nap, so I can't move.
We've got his light here next to each other, an otter. Well, actually, yesterday I was doing work, and you came upstairs, and you're like, do you want an otter right now? And it sounded so suggestive.
That sounds so dirty.
But it really just meant a 20-minute nap where we lay there on our backs holding each other's hands.
Yeah, it's kind of our spirit animal. So does this work if you don't have a partner? I think that's a big question, like, because not everyone has a partner. Not everyone has the same sleep schedules either.
Well, actually, you got me a stuffed Paddington Bear, which it's actually a pretty big stuffed Paddington Bear. Like if Paddington Bear is in bed, it takes up like a pretty good amount of space between us. But I'm pretty sure you could otter holding Paddington Bear, the stuffed Paddington Bear's hand.
Maybe
I think that would hold the same purpose.
A really heavy Paddington Bear could almost be like a weighted blanket. That sounds like the best thing.
But I got fascinated. So yesterday I did a deep dive on sea otters because I was like, let me learn more about creature that we're trying to embody. But yeah, the reason they do this is because like, you know, as they hold hands and it keeps them from like drifting apart in large groups, which I think is super cool. But sometimes they also like entangle themselves in seaweed as they sleep too, to prevent them from drifting down the sea, which I think is super cool.
Otters are freaks.
They're freaks, but they're basically me because, okay, so to start one, they have 2.6 million hairs per square inch on their body, which is impressive. And it's also like kind of like my eyebrow situation I got going on right now. So I was like, I identify with these otter creatures.
A little bit like my nose hair. So I can't.
Perhaps.
I can't.
We're
I
similar.
Can't
we're similar. They also eat 20 to 33% of their body weight every day, which is so cool. That is a lot of salt and vinegar potato chips.
And perhaps they're exercise physiologists. That's going to be topic one.
I know. We're coming to this topic. We're coming back to this. And they do a dance before pooping. So they call it the scat dance, where they kind of have like, they stomp their hind feet and lift their tails. And I think that's so cool. I was like, I want to embody a sea otter. But I will tell you, so yeah, last night I got very excited about sea otters and was telling David these facts. And the first words out of David's mouth were, how do they have sex?
And the answer is, don't Google that, because we were initially like, otters are our spirit animals. We love it. And the second Google response is, otters are depraved sex freaks. So yeah, don't Google it.
Don't Google that. And perhaps, yeah, don't embody that.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we should change the name to like, you know, being seaweed or something. Because I feel like seaweed aren't, no being, depressed sex freaks.
Barnacles. Involved. Barnacles. Because then we're just like, yeah, we're locked into bed. It's perfect.
Amazing. Like off the tip of your tongue. Pool there on like the animal kingdom.
This afternoon when like 2 p.m. hits and like energy levels are a little low, I'm gonna be like, do you want to go barnacle with me?
We're gonna barnacle so freaking hard. And then final big thing on the intro is, I heard this amazing quote. And like one of the things with the podcast is we always just try to throw shit against the wall to see what might stick with, you know, one listener during the week. And it was a quote from Conan O'Brien, or related to Conan O'Brien, which is, overthinking is overstinking.
I love that. Well, first of all, that like, I need to hear this word.
That's why
also,
I said.
Also, I really like things that rhyme because they just stick with me a little bit more.
Also, overstinking is amazing and very identifiable in
for
the pandemic.
For both of us, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, what he was talking about is in the writer's room. So in the comedy writer's room, how that phrase is used to be like, you can throw anything out there, that you're just not thinking, you're acting, you know, that your whole life has led to this moment where you don't have to think to embody what you're trying to create, you know? And I try to bring that into everything in life. I mean, that's what the podcast is. We prepare a ton. So it doesn't mean you don't prepare. You prepare a ton, but then you just don't think. It's go.
I think that applies to racing too. It's like, you know, you show up, you like, you're consistent in training, you know you put yourself out there, and then you come into race day and you just like throw it out there and see what happens and don't judge.
Yeah, and I think the ultimate blessing often is our brains, right? That lets us do all these things, but it can be the ultimate curse. Like I know, you know, during a presentation or something, I'll get in my own head and
I do that so often. It's like this third person narrating the presentation as it's happening. Oh, it's so funny that you bring that up.
What a nightmare. Yeah, and that I think everyone feels that to a certain extent. And then athletically, like I will overthink, you know, every time I'm doing a workout. There's actually a fatigue model for this. So the anticipatory regulation of fatigue. While you're doing an interval, you might be thinking about what's coming at the end of the interval rather than being in the moment. And
someone who's trying to go 13-0 and not 1-0, coming back to our mantra. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and where that might be most applicable to me is with coaching. So I found that when I coach athletes and I'm thinking way too much about like where the athlete's going, what the athlete wants, all these other variables, I turn into a self-conscious shitty coach.
Well, it's funny. I think for me, I'm such a collaborative coach. Like I really try to take in like how an athlete is feeling, like what drives them in training, what they find fun, and incorporate that into my training philosophy for that particular athlete. But I think that actually breaks down when it comes to athletes who may more naturally tend to overthink or to ruminate or obsess about
training. Oh, so you're internalizing their overthinking.
Because I'm internalizing their overthinking. And then it kind of creates this like spiral where we're just kind of going in circles. And I've learned over time as a coach, with that, you know, to kind of sense that and to put my foot down and to like hold my conviction and be like, you know, this is actually, and I think it actually helps those athletes a lot.
For sure.
Like, this is the training plan. I think it's right. Let's stick to this. You know, we'll incorporate the data points over time. But I think by holding my convictions, it actually really helps the athlete.
That's
in the
so
process.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. For me, it's like when the stakes are high or highest. So like with a professional athlete, sometimes I start thinking, well, this is how they put food on the table. This is everything. You know, this isn't just a question of a workout. This is like a question of their lives. And as soon as I start doing that, I'm start going down these spirals of like, well, what if this isn't the right way? What if this like injures them? Or what if this isn't enough? Or what if they think the volume isn't high? And it, for me, that creates like often my only really bad coaching experiences were like, you know, I turn into a self-conscious piece of shit coach is when I'm trying to give the athlete what they want rather than what I know they need and what comes naturally from like years, millions of log entries, millions of days coached, you know, all that stuff.
It's so funny that your brain does that, because I think I also do that too. Like, I think I have a tendency to kind of like ruminate or obsess over like these particular thoughts. And I think one crutch that I've used in my own life, which is not necessarily like a great thing, is this like, I just like really like rely on like diversity of thinking. So I think like I do so many different things in life. You know, I'm like, you know, doing science and school and racing and like all these different things and coaching
yeah.
that I think like I'm thinking from like 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. Yeah. And so like it prevents overthinking because yes, I simply can't. Yeah. It's like, I have to go so fast. But I think that's also been a crutch that I've leaned on in life. And I need to get better with these like open spaces where sometimes I need to like stay true and like hold my ground and like yeah. hold my conviction on
the
things.
Balance. Like,
yeah. Finding that balance in things. Yeah.
Is there any way you're thinking about doing that? Because like for me, what I always frame it as is a preparation thing. Like I want to prepare so fully that when I get to a moment, I don't have to think too much, which is something, it's a constant battle, right? Like, and it reminds me almost of improv comedy.
So yes. Yeah.
Don't Think Twice is an amazing movie by Mike Birbiglia. And it's called Don't Think Twice because that's a mantra in improv where you have all these rules. So improv has like, you know, the yes and rule, all these other different things that structure the world. But then within that world, you just blurt out what comes to mind. And sometimes it creates brilliant art. Sometimes it creates shit. But either way, it creates authenticity.
We both love comedy in that form.
Yeah.
Well, I think for me, it really comes back to like, I think about like the emotions that I have associated with thinking. Because I think like thinking is like, what are like philosophers, like yeah. people who are kind of like out there overthinking. And that's like, okay, that's beautiful. But I think for me, it comes down to the emotions associated with thinking and like where that thought pattern is going. So I think for me, like when I am like thinking or critical thinking, there's like an openness, like yeah. a sense of like oneness connected with that, or like a curiosity. And then I think when I'm overthinking, it's more of like obsession or ruminating, or like it's the same thought pattern that's like looping over and over and over again. And I think I really just try to tune into like the emotions that are happening when I'm thinking as to like where my brain might be going.
I love that. Maybe it gets back to like the Walt Whitman, curiosity on one end and judgment on the other. And that's probably what Conan O'Brien was talking about, is that in the writer's room, there is no judgment. You
that's,
know?
Oh, that's beautiful.
And
that's so true.
The problem is, like that might be easier to structure in a writer's room or an improv comedy team than in our own brains. Because at least for me, I'm constantly judging myself as a coach. Like I am always ready to judge, almost to the point that like, I'm so glad I have you to be my counterbalance.
Well, I think that's actually, I was gonna say, I think that's a good thing about a coach or a partner is, yeah. is that like you can take that thinking framework and turn it almost into reflection that's like turned into a positive light. Like yeah. I think athletes oftentimes, like, you know, if an athlete comes to me with a bad race, it's like, I think for me, it's not so much the race that matters, it's yeah. how you perceive and how you see that situation that matters most. And it's about helping athletes like reframe that and reflect on that in a way that is then positive.
Yeah. The hard thing for me is I, as a coach, I'll often internalize the athlete's bad race. So I'm like telling
you're the one,
something.
Yes, yeah.
They're the one that's like, David, this is okay. You know, just something to really resist, because I think that's also showing, you know, that judgment is implying that you have more control over any of this shit than you actually do.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah, and so like, okay, curiosity is going to be my jam. Curiosity, preparation, and not overthinking.
Well, I love the idea. And the last point on thinking too is I love the idea of rethinking. So yeah. Adam Grant recently wrote a book called Think Again. I'm like halfway through it. It's amazing. But he talks a lot about the idea of like rethinking and like mm-hmm. opening our minds to just like being able to like, you know, we're still learning. We're still, yeah. you know, we're still growing as humans. And I think this is a quote from Think Again. It's actually on the book jacket. And I think it's just like such a great summary. Intelligence is usually seen as the ability to think and learn. But in a rapidly changing world, there's another set of cognitive skills that might matter more, the ability to rethink and unlearn. In our daily lives, too many of us favor the comfort of conviction over the discomfort of doubt. We listen to opinions that make us feel good instead of ideas that make us think hard. We see disagreement as a threat to our egos rather than an opportunity to learn.
Mm.
We surround ourselves with people who agree with our conclusions when we should be gravitating towards those who challenge our thought processes. The result is that our beliefs get brittle long before our bones. We think too much like preachers defending our sacred beliefs, prosecutors proving the other side wrong, and politicians campaigning for approval, and too little like scientists searching for truth. Intelligence is no cure, and it can even be a curse. Being good at thinking can make us worse at rethinking.
Mm.
The brighter we are, the blinder to our own limitations we can become. I love that so much.
I love that. I just realized as you were reading, I would occasionally do like a
I heard that. I was like, oh, you're real feeling my reading right now.
I'm barnacling over here. but yeah, it's really interesting to think about like how a belief system and structure overlaps with like reevaluating that belief system and structure. And it brings me back kind of a little bit to the transgender athlete rights podcast we did last week. It's like the reason that we tried to present it in this really loving meet you where you are perspective is that we are not sure. And that's like, I think it's really good to have convictions, which is inclusion is the default, human rights first. But we
and standing ground to those convictions. So I think sometimes yeah. for me, when I think about rethinking, I go like in the opposite direction. Yeah. And I'm like, don't listen to anything I say. And I think it's especially as a female, and especially like,
yeah.
I think it's really powerful to have convictions, especially on topics that you feel passionately about, but like be open on many of the other ones. And I hope that's how we framed that like transgender podcast discussion.
Yeah, yeah. And that, you know, we're open to things changing with curiosity, hopefully, and want to do that with all the things. But once you know something, it's also okay to be an expert. And that's another thing that's I think maybe harder for you to embrace.
Oh,
you
know? I struggle at that so much. I almost every topic I talk about, I'm like, I'm not the expert on this, but here's what I think. But it's like, you know, I think there are some things that I'm an expert on, and I do that for that same thing. And it's so like, that's devaluing kind of like my thoughts and my convictions on that topic.
Meanwhile, I come in with like patriarchy behind me and I'm like, I'm an expert at putting away utensils. See this, like, this
see
pile?
See this plop?
Actually, why don't people just plop? You can see which ones are forks and spoons and knives. You don't need them separated.
And it's just a cycle. I mean, you know what I mean? We're going to take the same fork and knife and spoon out of that place and put it back. So it's...
when I end up in the emergency room with a gash on my hand from a sharp knife.
Actually, we don't have knives that are sharp anymore. That's the state of our existence.
Benefits to all of this. We're just planning ahead. So you want to get into topic one?
Let's do it. So topic one is on eating enough. I love this topic. We've actually gotten numerous questions about food, about energy availability, about the endocrine system, questions from MS, GH, RT, DE, many more too.
Yeah, yeah. This is a topic we've talked about a lot, but we always want to come back to it because it's so important and it might maybe influence one or two people listening about how they live their everyday lives. And so it was a Troner magazine article this week as well. And what motivated it for writing it was that the other week, an athlete did an amazing long run. And in their log, they just had a passing comment that afterwards I was hanging out with friends and couldn't really refuel as much as I wanted to. And you know, that was just a passing comment. But to me, it made my heart sink to the freaking floor knowing what might come of that sort of situation.
And we see that often. I mean, I think we see this like, you know, this situation play out day after day after day to the point where it leads to these like hormonal cascades that are pretty negative for long-term growth and long-term development as an athlete. Like, I think for us, we do a lot of analysis of blood work, whether that's through like physicians or Inside Tracker or like other people that have these like data points of blood work.
Yeah.
And sometimes we see it where just like there's certain markers and it can be like a cascade of markers that are just kind of flipped to like low normal. Like, it may not even be that they're like purely low or they're outside the reference range, but you just kind of see the things that just feel a little out of whack.
There. Yeah. Just like knobs are turned slightly in the wrong direction, which you never want your knobs turned in the wrong direction, I guess. But like, you know, it might not even be the type of thing that a doctor sees or Inside Tracker even notices. And it makes us question, it's like, what's going on here?
Especially when we see that. I think sometimes like an athlete can go in for a blood test and it's like, you know, it could be after a long run. Or it could be like in the middle of stress or they could have overhydrated or underhydrated. So it's like, I think when we see that like reflected across multiple data points, that's when it becomes like a red flag to
us. Especially when it's cross-correlated with like how they feel. You know,
that's
they're having fatigue or they're not performing as much as they want, or they might start getting a lot more niggles than they would usually get, or, you know, any number of different things. And what we always come back to is that this idea that you need to eat enough, that when we're talking about these numbers being turned sideways, it could be minor endocrine system changes that have massive downstream effects on how the body actually operates.
And what I really liked about the Troner article is that you kind of provided a summary of like what low energy availability is. And then you highlighted, I think very few articles have actually gone through and picked out all the different downstream effects that we know of. And then there's probably thousands that we're still like that are interconnected with variables that we're still even figuring out. But I loved how you structured that.
Eating is such a high stakes game. Emphasis on stake. But like when we're talking about this with athletes, I think it's easy to play it off. You know, when I've written articles like this in the past, there have been commenters say like you think eating enough is a problem. Like, you should see my mirror if you think that or whatever.
Or like, check out my brownie. What do you think that did for my blood glucose?
Yeah, exactly. And all these people being like, oh, well, that's not a problem in the US. And it's like, actually, that's a massive problem for athletes across the board. And the science is unequivocal on this. Like, there's very few points where exercise physiology and medicine and they all just perfectly overlap. And one of the main ones is on low energy availability. And low energy availability doesn't need to feel like restricting or intentional or anything. It just means that as an athlete, you're playing a high stakes game when it comes to exercise, background physiology, and getting enough fuel in.
And that could happen. So essentially that's the mismatch between, you know, how many calories you're consuming or how much fuel you're getting and then the amount of energy expenditure you're having. And I think the important thing about athletes is like many athletes that we coach are having very, very high energy expenditure. And I don't think some athletes like adequately account for that in the head, along with like the background basal metabolic rate that's happening to the body, because it's like, you know, you need to fuel really well for those situations.
Yeah. And to highlight for the listeners, Megan is one of the probably world's experts on this topic to something that you would never say, but you have to accept because we're talking about it on this podcast. I just nailed you into accepting that you're like a world expert. So as I'm talking about it, I'm kind of reading buzzwords I don't understand. And she's like, you know, writing a million papers on it.
But I think as we break this down, we're going to start with low energy availability. And that's the crux of a lot of people have probably heard of relative energy deficiency in sport or RADS or RED-S, and then the female and male athlete triad. And low energy availability is the crux of both of those. Those processes are essentially very similar processes, just describing slightly different end results. But I loved how you broke this down in Troner magazine, and you kind of you highlighted the different hormonal axes in which low energy availability is influencing. I thought that was super cool.
Yeah, so there was a great 2019 review article in Current Opinion and Endocrine and Metabolic Research that really digs down into all of this if you'd like to read more. But there's three main axes that we're thinking
nice
about here.
Nice plural there.
You I know, that. Right?
The first one is the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis. Say that word three times fast.
Say gonads.
But yeah, but it's essentially when what happens with low energy availability is you're having energy that's diverted away from reproductive functions. So oftentimes we'll see this in female and male athletes in the form of sex drive or sex function.
Yeah.
We're having reduced sex drive, feeling like sex function is not, you know, where it was once before, or may just have never been there. For female athletes, often we see amenorrhea or changes to the menstrual function, changes to the menstrual cycle. It's like the first sign.
Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting that you're talking about sex drive and, you know, menstrual function, I think, is the most important thing. So like, emphasize that if you're listening to this and you don't get your period or you have irregular periods, like, talk to your doctor. That really matters.
Actually, it's so funny. We've worked with athletes before that have irregular periods. And I would say that, like, for me, helping an athlete like reestablish their cycle is so, I mean, I've had calls from athletes to tell me like, oh my gosh, Megan, I got my period for the first time in 6 years. And it's like a way bigger celebration than even like winning a big race.
Oh yeah.
To me, it's like, this is like, we're setting like your body up for health and like long-term, you know, long-term exciting things. And I get so excited when I get those calls.
Getting period for the first time in a long time is better than like Western states.
I'm like one of those moms, like, you know, like when a 13-year-old girl or like 14-year-old girl gets a period for the first time, I'm like, let's party. Let's, you know, not, I mean, for athletes of like, of age, I'm like, let's whip out the champagne. Let's do it.
It's like that song, 99 Red Balloons. It's just like you with red balloons. Like, guys,
we got this.
But also sex drive and sex function. One thing people don't often talk about, athletes sometimes have, you know, poor sex drive, men and women. And so it's something that's really important to think about, and otters would be very disappointed in us. So let's make the otters happy, those depraved sex freaks, and get our energy intake up.
Got to get out there, an otter or barnacle, whatever is your favor. The next thing is the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is related to primarily, I mean, there's a lot of different hormones there, but one of the big stress hormones is cortisol.
Yes.
And we talk about that a lot in our podcast. And cortisol is actually interestingly connected to many different downstream processes. So like, if you cause a perturbation in cortisol, it causes so many issues with downstream processes, you know, like fundamental physiological processes. What I also think is really interesting is we see a lot of like mood changes in athletes who may not be getting enough energy. And depression is linked. So depression itself causes high cortisol levels, but there's also theories that high cortisol levels may cause depression. And so it's kind of like this, like this negative feedback loop.
So positive feedback loop.
That's actually very negative.
Very negative. Yes. And you know, as I've seen more and more about this, this is like a total non-scientist talking, that I almost feel that a cortisol model for adaptation for health is maybe one of the most appropriate. And where that's come from a lot of times is seeing these blood tests where you see chronically elevated cortisol. So cortisol elevated over multiple observations. And often all under, like as you talk to an athlete, you'll see that there's something that has not been communicated, whether that is related to, you know, binging and purging or depression or something else. Something that is not on the surface is reflected in this one variable and nothing else.
And kind of like picking at the puzzle piece and being like, you know, I know, or even like finding the tip of the iceberg and being like, I know there's a lot more out there.
And so that's
cortisol.
And that's eating is one of the biggest parts of that that really matters.
The other axis is the hypothalamic pituitary thyroid axis. And we see, so we look again, a lot of thyroid values. There's a lot of different like health conditions, disease conditions out there that do cause low thyroid, but low energy availability, not getting enough fuel actually does cause impacts on the thyroid. I do research on free T3, which is a thyroid hormone, and we see low free T3 associated with not getting in enough energy. But so essentially the thyroid hormone is involved in a lot of different things. I'm kind of like cortisol is just involved a lot of different bodily processes, but it's involved in metabolic rate. It's involved in cardiovascular health. What I think is interesting about thyroid is the impacts on metabolic rate. So sometimes in athletes, we actually see athletes who are not getting in enough energy have paradoxical weight gain. And that's because like their metabolic system is a little bit like fundamentally altered. And so, or even like water retention, there's a number of different things I can get at that like change in body composition. And so I think this is something that's so important because sometimes you can't just like look at an athlete and be like, oh, that athlete has low energy availability, or even look at yourself and look at like your weight patterns, because this goes so far beyond weight. And I think that's something that's actually really important.
So the mirror doesn't tell you anything about this. And it's fascinating to think about how the endocrine system works, because the endocrine system is one of the baselines that drives performance, adaptation, overall health, and mental health. So as soon as these knobs start getting
and
turned.
You forgot that. How did you forget that one, David?
Man, the otters are so disappointed right now. And, you know, when you add all that stuff together, it's like, okay, start turning these knobs down, and who knows what comes next, that there can be major downstream effects on everything. So Megan mentioned resting metabolic rate. Bone health is directly related to endocrine health. That's why there's certain like indicator bones that you often see, like a calcaneal stress fracture, but any bone health, all bone health is related to that. As Megan said, body composition, mental health, and then think about a physiological function of any type. I mean, you could talk about like skin quality, and I'm sure it's connected.
It is related. Yes. It is? Yes, oh, yes, man. It's related. Yes.
Nailed it. I'm such a scientist. I love it. And so the problem here is that it is not a calories in, calories out framework. It does not work based on equations. And there's a 2020 review in the International Journal of Sport Nutrition and Exercise Metabolism.
You crushed that.
I did. That is amazing. And you should read it if you're interested, but it gets into the uncertainty of all this. And I think that it highlights what we need to do as athletes and coaches to try to get out of these low energy availability slumps and really recognize the problem exists.
What I think about what is interesting about this is, so it highlighted a few different things. So one being a focus on calorie containing beverages and fun filling foods, which I think is like, talk about a quote. I love that quote. I think for me, sometimes, especially like female athletes drinking like diet sodas, it kind of pains my soul because it's like, no, you actually need, you know, you need energy, you need to like, you know, or even like diet Gatorade or things along those lines. It's like, you know, fuel your body well with the food that it
so needs. To give everyone a hint of how much of a child I am, I'm really into Nesquik. So I put Nesquik in just about every, actually my post, like sometimes I'll do doubles on the treadmill, like on uphills, and my post double drink is a big heaping scoop of Nesquik mixed with almond milk and salt. And for some reason it brings me back to childhood.
And you
so
get
much.
So excited for it.
Oh my
God. It's so fun.
I will do anything on the treadmill to get my Nesquik.
Other things the article highlights too are breakfast. Carbohydrates are really fundamental. If there's a word fundamental to healthy glycogen stores and endocrine health. I think another interesting thing, and I've seen this actually reflected in some research, I've seen this pretty wildly anecdotally, is that I think there's some nutrition paradigms out there that focus on having like seven mini snacks or like eight snacks throughout the day, as opposed to like having big meals. And I think for athletes, there is something very like satisfying, both like on like a physiological level and also on a mental level, about having big meals. I call it satisfaction bombs. Like for me, I think about like, you know, having a nice like steak for dinner or burger, and I feel this like immense satisfaction bomb, and I can feel that like in my brain. But I also love to think about like what is happening physiologically as I feel that satisfaction bomb. Like it's probably satisfying these like, you know, these hunger hormones, leptin, ghrelin. Like it's fascinating to think about like how that's playing out into my
and those hunger hormones can get fucked up by low energy availability.
And that's the other struggle too, is that sometimes like when you do have low energy availability, it messes up these hunger hormones that you may not actually perceive hunger.
Yeah.
And that's why I think intuitive eating, again, it's this nutrition principle out there about like, you know, eating like based off of hunger cues. And there's like a whole philosophy and school behind that. I think in some situations that can actually be dangerous for athletes, because like our hunger cues, you know, from doing long runs, if we have low energy availability, may be altered. And so it's really important, you know, not to always listen to that.
And I thought what you said about big meals is really fascinating, because there are multiple studies on within day energy deficits that found that even controlling for overall energy intake, so you get the same number of calories per day, magnified amounts of within day energy deficits caused increases in cortisol, decreases in sex hormones, like all these issues that we're talking about. And what was really interesting about that is frequency of meals was also associated with worse cortisol sometimes. So in other words, athletes that were spreading it out a ton, like you often might have been having some overall issues.
And there could be some confounding there, because I think like athletes that are spreading it out a ton probably have listened to like the school, you know, they're probably thinking heavily about nutrition principles.
Exactly,
but I do see that anecdotally reflected. And I think that's something that's a really fascinating point that you bring up.
Yeah. So we're not nutritionists. Please talk to a nutritionist. The idea here is always make sure you're eating enough. Like the phrase I always come back to is eat enough always, eat too little never. In that framework is really simple, but that's kind of what the research indicates too, that these aren't based on just like get this many numbers. It's based on try to find that satisfaction Megan's talking about. And that will also fuel your ultimate performance and adaptation and everything else that goes into, you know, being an athlete, because that's all connected to overall health.
I think working with a nutritionist, working with a physician, working with a coach on this topic can be super helpful, because like we're talking about this as research for the masses.
For sure.
But like certainly every athlete is going to have like individual needs on this topic. Like there may be some people who have like elevated glucose levels. There may be some athletes like, you know, who may need to follow like different dietary parameters, and that's awesome too. And I think working with a treatment team is a great approach.
Or on the flip side, there might be some athlete out there that you know, has temporary low energy availability and has some temporary success. And looking at that athlete in a snapshot is so unhealthy for everyone else because we're all working with different background genetic contexts.
I was going to say, like, how the genetics play in with those like, you know, as you talked about earlier, those dials that are being, like, slightly turned, like, in awkward directions. It's like, you know, some athletes may be able to sustain that for 2 months. Some athletes may be able to sustain that for 2 years. And that's just genetics interplaying with this low energy availability. And that's going to be different for everyone.
So zoom out and look at the moving pictures, right? That we're all essentially Jenga towers. That's the analogy I used in the article. And okay, within a deficit, low energy availability, whatever, you might just take out one piece. You might be playing, but you're kind of playing blindfolded. And so one piece might not be bad. It's not like every single day is the highest stakes game of your life, but add it together and we can all be crumbling towers. It's just a question of when it all falls.
And that piece is going to be different. I mean, statistically, it's going to be different for every athlete. You know what I mean? And I think it's really interesting how all this different, I mean, every athlete is their own unique Jenga and these different pieces coming together in different ways.
So, you know, food is fuel. Just like throw it all.
Think
in
about
fire.
Satisfaction bombs. Yes.
Think about sex. Think about otters.
Think about barnacling.
That's pretty much the message of the podcast.
Rate, subscribe, review, whatever you do to podcasts.
We love you all.
Woohoo!
Woohoo!
Bye.